Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This is my last day of the week. Tomorrow from 9 to noon, you're going to hear a special Thanksgiving program, so neither Bill Sayre nor I will be on. But on Friday, Vermont Viewpoint does return. Lee Cattell will be your host on Friday. Today, we've got open phones at 9:30, Bob Ney at 10. We'll hear from Ken Picard of 7 Days on the vanity plate applications that the DMV had to say no to. And then we'll finish off the day at 10:30, hearing from Governor Phil Scott. But let's start the day by going hiking. In the past few months, I've had several authors on the show sharing their exploits of hiking the Long Trail. And as they relate it, that's not easy. But what if you wanted to hike across the state? Joining me now is Greg Western. He's the executive director of the Cross Vermont Trail Association. Greg, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, to ask Greg Western about the East-West Trail across Vermont, give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Greg, what exactly is the Cross Vermont Trail?
Well, the idea is obviously in the name, a trail that goes across Vermont, and specifically following the Winooski River and the Wells River in order to go from Lake Champlain to the Connecticut River, New Hampshire border. And we are not so much a wilderness trail like the Long Trail, say, as a community trail. So our goal is to work with local towns, town forests, schools, so on, to promote, improve, and extend local trails with the idea that they would connect together to make a statewide route.
When and how did the idea get its start, Greg?
It started in the early 90s, and there was actually a lot of people talking about sort of that community path network type stuff in the early 90s, and I remember those times, and there was studies done, and at the time I thought, that'll never happen, it's just another study, but it actually started to happen, so things like, South Burlington has a big bike path network, which started as a study in the early 90s, and so on. The Cross Vermont Trail was founded by people who lived in more rural towns, and they said, well, how can we promote this idea, in other places? And so it was founded by people from Plainfield, Marshfield, Groton, Ragged, Newbury, that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so started in the early 90s with the idea of starting a nonprofit that would promote community trails, even if they're not in, larger municipalities.
So the idea was hatched back in the early 90s. How long have people been actually working on the Cross Vermont Trail?
Well, in the 90s, folks, it was sort of an ad hoc committee, and they would go to select boards and things and sort of advocate for the idea. In the late 90s, we actually had a big project, which is just this year finally happened, so that's how long things take sometimes, which is a bridge over the Winooski River in East Montpelier along Route 2. And the reason that was important was because there was an old railroad bed, the Montpelier and Wells River Railroad, which was traditionally used as a trail in many places, though not all, also a vast trail in many places. But there's a big break in it, and the big break was in East Montpelier. So you couldn't get from Barrie Montpelier area up to where the rail trail starts. And so in the late 90s, this ad hoc group of Cross Vermont Trail enthusiasts were trying to find a town or somebody who would take the lead to do this project. And at that time, no one would. these days, municipalities, towns in Montpelier and Barrie are more into bike paths, but in the 90s, not as much, I gather. And so we actually incorporated as an official nonprofit in 1999 in order to be able to build and own, and take responsibility for new sections of trail that connect between towns, where it's no one else's clear responsibility.
Well, tell us about this project, about the bridge being completed in East Montpelier across the Winooski.
Yeah, the it's right at the location of where an old railroad bridge was. So underneath the modern bike path bridge, you could see the old granite abutments for the 19th century bridge. Mm. And it reconnects about 4 or 5 miles of the old railroad, basically between the Gallus Hill Road, the Central Vermont Civic Center, the ice rink, up to Route 14 just south of East Montpelier on the road towards Barrie, where, again, this old railroad begins. And we got a big federal highway grant in 2005. So all this infrastructure bill that got passed this year, sometimes it takes a while before the money gets spent, but we have spent it now. We are a small nonprofit, and it took us 15 years to go through the V-Trans process. Wow. To get a project approved to build a very significant bridge, 200 feet long, and miles of new trail, including alongside the highway. But we did go through all that process. We got permitting and all that, and the biggest amazing thing for me is, a lot of times with highway projects, the feds will pay 80% and the town will pay 10% and the state will pay 10%.
Right.
But for us, there's no town and state. So we had to raise the 20% from local donations, which miraculously we did do.
Wow. Patience, persistence, probably a lot of frustration, but 15 years later, what an accomplishment. You keep saying we, so who is involved in putting together this trail and, getting it built out?
The Crossmont Trail Association itself, again, is an incorporated nonprofit. So we have I'm the only staff member. So our goal is to be the big, just enough to be responsible. So to get to qualify for grants, to be able to get permits and to reassure the permitting entities that we can comply with the permits and so on. To be just big enough to do that, but no bigger. That's the low overhead. So we have one staff member, which is me. And then we have a very active board. So there's 7 to 10 people, depending on the year, on the board. And they are, they're a treasurer and a secretary. And so a lot of the stuff that at a large organization staff would do, mm-hmm. Board members do. And then we have, there's several hundred people who are sort of dues-paying members of the association each year. We also work, the way we get things done is in partnership. So, we're sort of coordinating being the air traffic controller for this big project, but it's, definitely a lot of people pitching in, several state agencies, the V-Trans, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as the U-32 school, a group of people who are, who want to use the trail for a portage trail, so they're kayakers and canoers and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're helping us build part of the trail, and so on. So there's a big partnership.
Well, when it's complete, you'll be able to go from Burlington to Wells River, from the Connecticut to Lake Champlain. But right now, where can someone get to on the Cross Vermont Trail?
We have maps on our website, which is crossvermont.org. And right now, the idea is to you could go the whole way. It's just a lot of it's on road. Mm-hmm. So right now, it's a scenic route is the V-Trans term of art. So, because if you say trail, that implies pretty specific stuff. So right now, it's a route. And so the state's 90 miles wide, at this latitude. And of that 90 miles, about 35 are trails. On our route, and the rest is on road. And the trails are not all in a row. Although the longest section of trail is Groton State Forest, so a lot of people like that section of rail trail. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously a lot of trails in the Chittenden County because of all the work that Burlington, South Burlington, Williston have done. And then otherwise it's sort of scattered through the state. And so the purpose of our maps is so that if folks get to the end of a bike path and it says, bike path ends, Our goal is don't believe it. Don't stop at the bike path end sign, because if you take this local road for another mile or two, there's another bike path that starts. And so the purpose of our map is to let people connect together existing trails using the best available roads. But honestly, some roads are not the best available. So like Route 2 in East Montpelier, for example, is very high speed trucks. So we're trying to get off of the worst roads. Some roads are very nice. They're quiet dirt roads.
And you said 35 of the 90 miles now are trails. What would be the, when it's complete, will it be all trail?
Yeah, yeah. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. So it'd be essentially a 90-mile route, maybe a little longer, depending if there's zigzags.
Right.
And but yeah, that's absolutely the goal, is a continuous off-road route. And the idea is that it's trails that go places. So, I mean, one of our slogans is connecting villages, schools, and wild natural areas or parks. So we want, it's a network of trails. So you would go to a trailhead at your neighborhood park or at your school, and it could connect to other schools the next town over, or to conserve natural areas or parks or state forests, things like that in between.
Oh, excellent. Greg, because your name, was it important that the trail ran across the state? I'm just thinking, if you were named like Greg Cattycorner, would we be hiking from Canaan to Bennington?
That's a good question. I came in after that decision had already been made.
All right.
The original idea was, although one of the side trails is called the Western Trail, but there's no relation.
All right.
The original idea was, again, inspired by this Montpelier to Wells River Railroad, and the idea was that if you're going across, if you're going to have a community trail, the way to go is along the river valleys, and so they flow east-west. So that was sort of I should add as a background information that some of the original founders were geologists. So that's how they think.
Really neat. Let's go to the phones and talk to our friend in Corinth, Forbes. Hi, Forbes.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good.
Most of our trail systems, if you go back through history, were established Indian trails. And that's how they moved from one point to part of the state to the other. Mm-hmm. In our particular area, the Waits River was named after Colonel Waite, who patrolled the river against raids of communities along that area. But the Indians pretty well established our original trail systems.
Good point, Forbes. And Greg, is this, can you tell if any of the trail or most of the trail does follow Native American trails through the state of Vermont?
Because of the river, the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
My research is not extensive as I would love it to be, but there's definitely accounts of the Deerfield raid, in the whenever that was, 1700s, 1600s. So people would be captured, I guess, from Massachusetts by Abenakis and carried up to Canada, and the captives would write down their story. And so we have firsthand accounts of the routes that people took when they were traveling across Vermont. And one of them is definitely the Wells River to the Winooski River. It's a natural route. And so that just happens to be, a story from a war. But it's assumed that in normal times people would use that same route as well. We actually, because of permitting, we have to do archaeological assessments of the route. I did ask the archaeologist who was surveying the route, would there be any physical record or evidence telling that story of the Native American use of the corridor? And he said basically no. We know that folks used it, but the actual physical traces of that are not seeable today. So the actual trail route is a new built trail. It's not an ancient path, but the idea of following the rivers is an ancient idea.
Yeah, so more in theory than in maybe actual practice. What are your goals? I think you're done for 2021. So what are your goals for next year, for 2022?
We'll have a big ribbon cutting ceremony at the end of May for the first segment of the new path in East Montpelier. Mm-hmm. And it will continue the Montpelier bike path upstream, past the U-32 school, across the river, and out to a new trailhead parking lot on Route 2. So it'll add a couple miles to the Montpelier bike path all along the river. And then after that, eventually our goal, of course, is to get up to Route 14. So we'll keep chipping away at it. The big contractor-built parts of the project are done this year. So we did get this giant federal grant, like I had mentioned before, and we hired regular contractors to build the big bridge over the Winooski and also some more technical work like the parking lot, like installing a new guardrail along Route 2 for a short section so to allow the path to be beside the highway. And then we're out of money, or close to being out of money. We still have some. So the and so the rest of it we're building in a more low-key way. So AmeriCorps crews, Youth Corps crews, volunteers, there's plenty of opportunity for volunteers who want some of our seasonal staff, stuff like that. So we're chipping away at the remainder of the project, which is the it'll take longer than the contractor portions just because we're doing it the slow way by hand.
Projecting it, Greg, do you have an idea? You seem to be about 40% completed. So when do you think the trail will be done from end to end?
Well, from Lake Champlain to the Connecticut River, it's hard to say. And the reason is because it's so much based on partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, say, the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, which a lot of people know about, state owns the right-of-way. The state owns the old railroad bed. So it's really just a matter of money. Like, we just have to spend the money and rebuild it. Whereas the Cross Vermont Trail is, there's no specific place that it's going to go. It's a matter of working with landowners, working with communities. Where do people want trails in their communities? And just having those conversations. People talk a lot these days. The word "let's have that conversation" is sort of a cliche, but that's really the situation we're in. So it's an ongoing, and it could the dam can break for a long section, like here in East Montpelier. All the landowners along the route got on board, the funding lined up, and now we can just go for it and do it.
Yep.
And in other places, you could talk to 10 landowners in a row, and five or six could be into it, and three or four could be still thinking about it, and so you just have to wait and keep talking until the next chance to do a long section.
All right.
So that's a long way of saying, don't know.
That's all right. And it's great to hear some of the things you're having to face. Let's go to Burlington now. We're going to talk to Frank. Hi, Frank.
Good morning. Quick question for your guest. This trail, I've been listening to you. I'm on the website now. Is this trail accessible across the entire state by bicycle?
Yes. The idea is that all the trails that we work on, Cross Vermont Trail, or all the local trails that we designated as part of our route, can be used by bikes. There's a variety. So like in Burlington, the bike path is asphalt. In Montpelier, the bike path is asphalt. In East Montpelier, it'll be crushed gravel. Like the town of Groton, it's just the old railroad bed, so mm-hmm. it's sort of sandy, gravelly. But the surface varies, and so it's you might want a sturdier bike. It doesn't need to be a mountain bike, but a hybrid bike or a cross bike, that kind of stuff. Our goal is everything that we call a part of the Cross Vermont Trail route can be used by bikes.
Oh, that's an exciting prospect for cyclists. Frank, thanks for that question. Since it's passing through towns, Greg, will this be something more akin to the that Southwest Coast Path in England where you hike to the next town and can stay in an inn overnight, or in this case, maybe a motel or a B&B?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And people do that. We've definitely, in the last couple of years, because of the what everybody knows about, and also we've been getting I've been getting a lot more emails from people who are planning longer trips.
Yep.
I'm assuming that's just a percentage of the people. But, again, most people who use the trails within our route live nearby. So when I'm out on the trail, I'll often see the same people every day. And they'll walk in their dog. One person was walking their cat, which I liked. and grandparents riding bikes with their kids, stuff like that, or their grandkids. But a certain percentage are making those longer trips. And we also have a partner organization or a sister organization, which is the Cross New Hampshire Trail. Mm. The Cross New Hampshire Trail was started by a woman who did the Cross Vermont Trail and got to the New Hampshire border and said, oh, let's keep going. And she's an ambitious person, so it actually goes to Bethel, Maine. And that seems to have created enough of a length that it's attracting people from away, you know. So people will start in Burlington and they'll go all the way to Bethel. And something about once a week, twice a week, I'll get an email from someone who's planning a trip. And they often ask me where to stay. And we used to think maybe people would camp. There's a couple of state campgrounds that about one-third and two-thirds of the way across the state. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are looking for an Airbnb or a regular B&B type place.
Oh, excellent. And you mentioned need for volunteers. So, Greg, how can people get involved? Because this is an ambitious project, but it needs a lot of help.
Yeah, and basically our website's the way. Like I said, we have low overhead, so there's our virtual presence is most of our presence. But crossvermont.org. We also have an email newsletter, a work party this week newsletter. So if folks go to the website, they can sign up for that, and it's just like a very short email whenever we have a work party scheduled, just in case folks want to come out as a notice. And there's a lot of we're building the trail, you know, by any means necessary. So the volunteer effort is, the smaller part of the total construction effort, but it's still an important part, and it's also the fun part. It's the cool stuff. So we're building, for example, next summer, we're building a series of wooden bridges things like that, and so. It's super expensive to pay someone to do that. Like, yep. Carpentry is, it's very time consuming, but it's fun to do for volunteers. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to steer volunteers towards.
All right. Greg Western, Executive Director of the Cross Vermont Trail Association, and you can go to crossvermont.org. Greg, it's been great learning about the trail this morning. Thanks so much. All right, take care. CBS News up next, and then we'll open up the phones, talk about Thanksgiving with a side helping of civility. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. All right, we've got phones open right now for the next half hour, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I'd love to continue our discussion from yesterday on Thanksgiving traditions and the non-traditional things that have become traditions in your family. We heard yesterday from a family in Hinesburg that use an African poiki, and that's spelled P-O-T-J-I-E, pronounced poiki, pot to make the most delicious turkey. In Cabot, folks head to the Bothfeld farm to pluck turkeys and gather around for traditional fare. Today in Montpelier, volunteers coordinated by National Life Group are out delivering Thanksgiving meals to those who need some help this year. In East Corinth, the folks at Northeast Slopes are looking for volunteers so that gem of a Vermont institution can be a place for friends and family to gather starting right after Christmas to ski and ride. And Thanksgiving is a time for families to gather and unite. And I know that it seems that in some instances, family members were having difficulty sitting across the table from one another because discussions of what people believe divided us. For the past year on this show, I've been striving to have opinions offered and accepted and respect restored. So attempting to find the commonalities that we have rather than the differences. there is a way to speak to one another with love and understanding, and I hope we're all on the road to doing that. And I'd love for you to share the great stories of your family this half hour, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And that whole idea of finding the commonalities and finding ways to communicate with one another. Last night when it was time, I should have been headed to bed. All of a sudden, a notice came up on my Facebook that the Dalai Lama was speaking. I'm on his page. I'm a follower. And when he speaks, they tell me, and he's in Brazil. This is his fifth visit to Brazil. And so it's bedtime, and rather than do what I should do and head off to bed, I think, no, I've got to hear the Dalai Lama. And I'm glad I did, because he speaks very plainly, but with such depth. And you know, I had written you know, that we need to sit across the table from one another and hear each other and enjoy each other's company again, no matter what either side believes, right? And here's the Dalai Lama, and kind of has that same message, so I felt pretty good about it. He started out by saying, compare the size of our brains to the size of elephants, right? You would think the elephant would have the supreme intellect, but we have intelligence, humans do. But he said that that intelligence must be combined, and I love this term that he kept using, with warm-heartedness and compassion. And when we do that, it provides better health and inner peace. You know, we're learning that if we find ways to reduce stress, if we find ways, you know, to calm ourselves, we do live longer. We do have better health outcomes. And he said anger and self-centeredness creates the problems in our planet and, you know, on our planet. We need calmness and less fear. And he prescribed for schools that we teach warm-heartedness. And he was very clear about this, not as a religious belief. Obviously, the Dalai Lama, a religious leader, but saying we don't need to teach this as a religious belief, but teach it as how it helps the body and clears the mind. And then he said something again. I felt like I was writing the script for the Dalai Lama, but it's probably that I have, you know, through my reading, have adopted some of the ways of Zen Buddhism. And I've always said that the smile is the international language. So as I've traveled to different parts of the world, if you are positive, if you smile, then there's a connection. And whether you speak the same language or not, even crossing the border into the townships in Quebec, where, I mean, 2 minutes across the border, French is spoken, and in many places no English, somehow you learn to communicate. And he said the smile is that thing that we understand in all languages. And I thought, boy, there it is. You know, let us find that warm-heartedness. Let us communicate through smiles. And let's remove the anger and self-centeredness that does create the problems in our planet. So it was an absolutely wonderful evening of listening to the Dalai Lama. And he doesn't speak for long. That's the other great thing about listening to him. he gets to the point pretty quickly, and then he starts taking questions. And so I really love that so much. Yeah, he's always got love at the center of everything, and love and laughter, those are what I live for. So it was a pretty neat talk last night. I want to hear you talk. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We can talk about cooking catastrophes. I've got one for you that I'll share. This one isn't necessarily Thanksgiving related, but I think you'll get a chuckle out of it. I want to mention one more thing. It seemed so perfectly aligned with hearing the Dalai Lama last night. Yesterday, it was the second last day. Today is the last day, unfortunately, of a restaurant in Vermont, in Essex. I went in, and it's a great little noodle shop. And, in my fortune cookie, it was not so much a fortune, but I guess kind of a character appraisal. And it said, "You are never bitter, deceptive, or petty." And I like to believe that's the truth, but, boy, it is that message again of warm-heartedness, of removing anger and self-centeredness. If we can never be bitter, deceptive, or petty, and we all sit across the table tomorrow with aunts, uncles, cousins, moms, dads, brothers, sisters, grandparents, friends, invitees, drop-ins, whomever, and not be bitter, not be deceptive, not be petty, just be accepting. It'll make for a wonderful holiday, better digestion, better health. You'll enjoy your turkey more. You'll enjoy the taste of it or whatever you're eating tomorrow. So I'm roasting up a chicken is what I'm going to do. Uh-oh. Sounds like you're going to be listening to a lot of me if we don't get a few calls here in the next few minutes. I'd love to hear about your plans for this Thanksgiving. You can share some of the amazing food that your family makes for this special holiday. This day when we're asked to give thanks. Cooking catastrophes would be great. Now, maybe you're all waiting to call in at 10:30. We will have the governor on from 10:30 to 11, but you can call in now and call in then at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I did promise a cooking catastrophe, and this wasn't on Thanksgiving. I'll give one there too. Both of them occurred in college. So, it's almost like you had a free pass, but, one was, there were, three of us who cooked together in college in the apartment. And so, you're all kind of learning what to do, right? You have minimal cooking skills, some better than others, but you have to go shopping, grocery shopping together. And the first time you do, is probably the worst, but okay, let's buy some rice. Okay, good. There's, minute rice, which is an easy thing to make, right? There's very, very little way of screwing that up, but minute rice is probably 50 cents more. And this bag of traditional rice, of regular rice, we'll make much more rice. It'll go further. And so let's get that rice. And so we buy it and none of us know how to make it. And so the first time we just start cooking away and the water's cooking out and it's getting, this film of starch on it. And we have no idea what we do. And at the end of cooking the rice very poorly, we throw it in a colander and have to rinse off all the starch. We rinsed the rice. We still laugh about it. Now I could probably make rice blindfolded. Sometimes I check the packet because it might be, different amounts, if I buy a packet, how much water I need to put in. But again, you really can't screw it up. It's pretty simple, Bring that water and maybe a little butter to a boil for 1 minute, throw in the rice, put the lid on, turn it down to low, and let it go for about 20 minutes, and then you should be good to go. Anyway, that's one. But the other was making a turkey, and one of our friends was convinced that you had to baste it every, I'm going to say, 15 minutes, right? And so we would, you know, open up the oven, pull it out, and start basting it, even though there might not be anything to even baste, every 15 minutes. Now, you can imagine what's happening here, because that temperature of the oven is dropping every time you open it up, pull that bird out. It took forever. I think we were planned to eat at like 5. We ate about 9:30 that night. We finally got the idea that stop opening the oven door. Stop basting it so much. This bird will never get done. So be patient with your bird. All right, let's go to Mark in North Ferrisburg. Mark, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Morning. What's up?
I have a pumpkin cheesecake almost ready to come out of the oven.
Oh.
And I wanted to say I've done the same thing that Kaya did. One time I took the turkey out and we're cutting it up, and sure enough, the giblets were still in the bag.
Oh, yeah. I think everybody does that at least once, right? It's almost like a rite of passage.
Pretty much.
It should be said, though, right, Mark, that it doesn't really hurt the bird. But there's better things you can stuff in that cavity, pull those out, and stuff something nice in there, right?
Oh, definitely. And I've had the partially frozen turkey before that took two extra hours to cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, thermometers can save you.
They can indeed. And, yeah, it always seems like, oh, yeah, I'll just pull the bird out. You know, it'll thaw. Those big birds take a long time to thaw out, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And the longer you let it rest, the more moist it's going to be also.
So once you pull it out of the oven.
Yep.
Yeah, let it rest. I know you want to dig into it right away. Yeah. My grandmother was the master of, I don't know how she did it, orchestrating all the things that she made, and everything just turning out perfectly. But yeah, there the bird would sit for a while she was finishing off everything else before she'd call in Uncle Dick to start carving it. So she knew, right?
It is quite the feat to pull off a Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
It takes a village. Yes, it does.
The pumpkin cheesecake, tell us a little bit more about that. You certainly, that sounds like the most delicious thing on earth.
Well, I usually just do a regular cheesecake, but I heard everybody's trying the pumpkin, and I thought I'd try it out.
Oh, so this is kind of new to the Mark product line?
Yep, pretty much. We're not going to put it on shelves yet. We have to do a taste test tomorrow.
All right. Well, have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy
it. You too, and happy Thanksgiving to all.
All right. Take care, Mark. Wow. Pumpkin cheesecake right there. I'm with you. I'm going to be stalking the homes in North Ferrisburg looking for a pumpkin cheesecake tomorrow. Boy, that sounds phenomenal. Yeah, you know, left to my own devices, I'm not a baker, so I don't really worry about desserts. But when someone has something like that, I'm not going to walk past it. Got to have pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving. Well, I love the pumpkin flavoring. I'll get pumpkin ice cream. I did go to the Morris Farm when they had the pumpkin spice creamy and did do the twist with the maple creamy. And I got to tell you, that is worth driving to Montpelier for whenever they have that. It is delicious. So love that a lot. All right, we're still open for a few more minutes. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can tell us what is the wonderful dish you make, like we heard from Mark. If you've got a cooking catastrophe, like you heard from me, you can share those as well. We're going to go to Moncton next and speak with Serena. Good morning, Serena.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. Hey, so as I'm listening to you guys today and for the past few days, I'm thinking about chestnuts people's experiences with preparing chestnuts.
Hmm. Are you looking for advice?
Well, I am, because I've heard two people right off the bat say not to put them in your oven because they'll explode.
Oh, interesting. Boy, I wish, you know, on Sunday I was over at a friend's and she made a chestnut mushroom soup that was phenomenal. And she would know. I don't know. I've never cooked with them.
Maybe she'll call in and give a suggestion. But for me, I love the idea of roasted chestnuts.
Yes.
And we're not really celebrating Thanksgiving because of COVID, so we're going to drive around and deliver chestnuts to people. Oh. And I'm trying to figure out the best way to prepare them before I leave.
Oh, interesting. There's got to be, you know what I do when I don't have, you know, one of my chef friends or really good cook friends to call on. I go online quickly, but we're getting a couple calls real here. So, Serena, don't go away. Let's keep Serena and see if one of these other calls coming in has chestnut advice. We're getting down to the end of the hour, but maybe we can get somebody in here. And bring this up on a different line. So keep Serena on, and let's go with Scott and Stowe. Scott, what do you got for us?
I just started using chestnuts recently because I saw a recipe from, I think it's Giada De Laurentiis or something.
Yep.
She has a cooking
sure.
show.
Yep.
And it's a chestnut radicchio bacon stuffing.
Ooh. Oh.
And it's...
Ooh.
Incredible.
All right. And, you know, that's the thing.
So what you do is, in order to keep them from bursting, I didn't know they would explode, but you cut an X on the round side of the chestnut with a sharp knife. You just make a small X, and then that facilitates peeling them.
Not so easy, right?
What's that?
Not quite so easy to do, though, right?
To cut, make the X?
Right.
You need a really sharp knife.
Right.
But and then it makes it easy to peel them. But what I did was I actually just, because I didn't really know, because everybody told me, oh, you need to roast them first. But her recipe did not indicate that. So I just peeled the chestnuts, as they are. I was able to peel them. I used like a peeler. And that's not very easy either. But then I didn't roast them. I mean, obviously, when I'm cooking this, in the stuffing in the oven, it's roasting them. I just chopped them, the... whatever you call them, fresh chestnuts peeled into the stuffing and worked fine.
All right, Scott, we're going to bring in John real quickly from Moortown. John, what do you have to say? We've got about 10 seconds.
Okay, quick Brussels sprout story. My wife plants them in this garden in Marblehead, where we're headed today, and the rats or the mice ate all the Brussels sprouts. Oh, we would eat them now. She would grow them right through till now, and we cook them for Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
But the rodents got at them, so now we have to buy Brussels.
Oh, John. All right. Serena, I hope online you might find some more information about chestnuts, and if we learn anything more, we'll let you know. All right. That'll do it. We got Bob Ney up next, and we're going to take a break for the top of the hour CBS News. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. National correspondent Bob Ney usually joins us on Friday, but today feels like the weekender, and it is for many of us. So Bob joins us now to catch us up on what's happening around the country and the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
Bob, let's take a look at the COVID numbers to start with.
Right. Got some numbers, and then I have some confusing information for you, if you'd like it.
Sure.
We can tackle that.
All right.
Globally, the COVID deaths are 5,162,675. And in the U.S., total deaths are 772,000. Going down to the cases, since we talked last, the current 7-day moving average increased 16.1% in cases across the U.S. Some are higher in certain states and some are, not as high, but 16.1%. The vaccination hasn't moved much since we've talked the last 3 weeks, frankly, Rick. It's still 68.9% for two vaccinations. One vaccination, 68.7. So some people have gotten one and not the second. And then there was an 11% increase in the booster. Now, the hospitalization has a 5.4% increase from the prior 7-day average, and the death rate has decreased 2.4%. So the death rate went down as, you know, some of the other items went up.
Yeah.
Now, when I said about confusing, if you look at the states are ranked by the COVID hospitalization rates, you know. So if you look at, for example, Vermont, it was Ohio was a little bit above it. Vermont's about, New Hampshire's the number one. It had a 60% increase. And then I would say Vermont's about 8, Ohio's 7. There was a 20% increase in Vermont in the hospitalization. But then if you go back and you look at the death rate, then Vermont is in, and they do them 1 in 100,000. Your highest states for the death rate is Montana, Kentucky, Idaho, North Dakota, West Virginia, Michigan, Oregon. Then it starts to drop, and Vermont goes all the way down to 0.025. And for example, Montana is 1.19. So it's kind of all over the place. The reason I went through that whole long spiel, it's just kind of all over the place.
Yeah, everything's kind of defying any real trends. You know, in the last week, you know, our daily average is down, you know, now to around 200 a day, which months ago or a year ago, that would have made our hair fall out, but we had weeks of 500, you know, a day. And so it's hard to get an idea now, especially with the Delta variant, of what it is, what it means. I guess just precautions prevail, especially as we come upon family gatherings tomorrow and through the end of the year.
Well, we have a family gathering tomorrow. My father's 98. He got his booster. I got my booster same day. We have some family members who have not gotten vaccinations, and they don't go out much, but they're vulnerable at 75 with health conditions.
Right.
And then you have some younger ones. And so, you know, I think the advice there is, you know, for the ones that haven't been vaccinated, they need to consider masks or, you know, maybe not being there.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I am going to ask you to give our listeners maybe some advice, tips on keeping family discussions civil, you know, because you are a politician or were a politician, and yet you have always, you know, been that kind of bipartisan, reach across the aisle type of guy. And in our discussions, you keep things, you know, both left and right. You're very fair. So I would call you, you know, very diplomatic. How do when people sit down? Last year, they probably didn't get together with family. You know, the political spectrum is wide within families. How do you keep those family discussions civil?
I have one niece who would, you know, crawl across glass for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another niece that would do that for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, so, a normal family, normal American family.
Very normal family.
Yeah.
And then in between, and, you know, I try to, I mean, they'll ask me things, and I will give them, you know, what I consider a candid, honest version of the flaws of both sides, both parties, and, you know, candidates and things that, you know, have happened. But some of it has ventured into some really horrific arguments, not with me, but internally with family members of ones vaccinated or not vaccinated.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a political argument. What I do try to tell them is, if you don't believe you want to be vaccinated for a variety of reasons, I think if you make your, it's more palatable for a civil conversation, don't just say it's because of Joe Biden or Donald Trump.
That's right.
I think if you can avoid that, you know, what's your real reasons? You know, I don't think you base a vaccination on a political candidate. At least I don't think we should.
Never been a good idea. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about gas prices. You know, one thing that we have such short attention spans, but I can remember October of last year as we were knee-deep in the election cycle, you know, it was predicted that gas prices would rise no matter who was elected because of, you know, things happening in the supply chain, et cetera. But now Joe Biden decides to tap into the national reserves. So explain to people what they are. Why does the country have national reserves? How big are they? How big a dent will it make what he's tapping into now?
Well, it's a great question, Rick. And I, by the way, I have dealt with it when Bill Clinton was president 21 years ago, because he is the last president to tap the reserve. I have been all over the board, by the way, on this. With Clinton, I was against tapping the reserve. When Bush was president, I was for tapping the reserve because we were also in a wartime situation, but Bush didn't do it. Clinton didn't feel we should have done it at the time. He did do it. So let's look at what the reserves are real quick here. They are actual, you know, 650 million barrels, and they are in the salt, the only way I can put it is the salt chambers, man-made produced chambers with salt, and the barrels are there. There are 650 million of them, and it's along the coast of Texas and Louisiana where we house them. Mm-hmm. Now, when Clinton was president, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, and if I am, usually one of your listeners will find out.
All right.
Correct me. They're pretty good about that. I love your listeners. But I think we released them. It was probably about 30 million barrels, and we put them out, quote, into the system. And I think if we look at the history of that, it did very, very little to help anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this time is going to be a little bit different, and I don't think this has been in a lot of stories, but of these barrels, President Biden is intending to release, I believe, 18 million barrels to China and India to help, quote, with the world situation, and then 32 million barrels here domestically. That, of course, Rick, I don't have to tell you, is going to raise eyebrows when people find out that the plan is 18 million barrels to China and India. People will be like, how does that help us, you know, at all? So I think that the president probably feels he has to do something.
Right.
Is this going to do something? No.
Right.
Didn't do it when Clinton was president. Probably wouldn't have done it if Bush had listened to us either.
Right.
But I think he feels he has to do, you know, something.
Right.
Here is the problem they're going to have. Right now, with the climate bills and the infrastructure, human infrastructure bills, et cetera, a lot of people are pushing, you know, climate change, electric cars, you know, solar, et cetera, which is a notable goal. Here's the problem. Fossil fuels are in our DNA. And unless you can find a scientific way to get around them, we're going to have these issues with gasoline for a long, long time, unless you can, again, find some scientific way to make the cars run in a different manner and where everything turns electric all at once, and then you have additional problems. So I'm not sure that clear messages politically are going to be sent on this whole deal.
Yeah. And Bob, your point is well taken on everything you mentioned. The effect on prices would be, I'm guessing, quite minimal. It seems to me like Joe Biden has to do this more of in a political gesture, showing people he's doing something as opposed to doing nothing as prices rise.
Right, because people have said, you know, and you made a good point, they were going to rise anyway, but presidents will benefit when prices are low. When prices are high, people will say, well, Joe Biden has nothing to do with that. Well, he's the president. If it's low, he gets a better
That's
credit.
Right.
If it's high, he's going to get some blame. Now, here's his problem, is that in doing something versus nothing, they're going to be analyzing what that something he did, you know, what impact did it have. And I think he's not going to particularly win on this one. And again, I can just see the ads. When our gas prices rose, Biden gave China and India gasoline from our reserves.
Yeah, that is definitely going to cause ripples, if not a wave. National correspondent Bob Ney, thank you for spending time with us. Best of luck with the two nieces on the opposite side of the political spectrum. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right. I've seen a Tesla with a Watt Fun license plate. Saw another one that was a big Starline Rhythm Boys fan, SRB fan number one. Those were very cool. But what are the rules regarding vanity plates, and which ones has the DMV just said no to? In this week's 7 Days, staff writer Ken Picard takes a look at this, and he joins us now to let us know all about it. Ken, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good to be back, Rick.
Hey, Ken, I want to apologize right up front because I know many of the plates that you write about in the column, you will not be able to say on the air because of the, you know, that FCC thing. So do your best when I ask you questions to step over, the really naughty ones. All right.
So, got it.
Are there any vanity plates that you've seen out on the road that you really thought, wow, that's really clever?
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely there are some that have sort of flown under the radar. And I actually wrote about some about 10 years ago, but this time, somebody had written in to ask me why, it was kind of a more mundane question, why they didn't see any I or J combinations. And so I reached out to the DMV just to see why. And then while I was writing to them, I figured, hey, let's see if I can get a list of all the vanity plates that they rejected. And I had no idea I would get back a list of more than 24,000 plates that people had tried to get in there. And what's amazing about that list is the people at the DMV do a pretty good job of figuring out what people are trying to say. So that was kind of impressive. Suffice it to say, if you request the number 69 and your car was not issued in 1969, it's probably not going to fly.
Ah, got it. All right. That's right off the list for anybody who was thinking about that plate. Is there a general rule of decency and decorum that the DMV uses to determine whether or not to issue a vanity plate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything that is overtly or even subtly sexual in nature is not going to get through. Anything that they consider in poor taste, insulting, racist, or even just racial. So people have requested Arab, they've requested Jew, they've requested honky. Things like that are just not going to get by. Nor are any references to drugs or alcohol. And what was surprising, I think the drugs people can understand that, but even alcohol references are not considered acceptable, whether it's a specific name, a brand name like Budweiser or something like that. Somebody requested Miller Time. Those things didn't get through. But there are also things that are a lot more, that you would think would be supportive of Vermont's alcohol industry, barman or beer nut or, sort of more highbrow, cognac didn't get through, Merlot didn't get through, scotch, whiskey barrel, all these things. I think the idea is they're really just trying to keep things clean on the road. And also any references to violence that, whether it's, sort of gang related, Crip or blood kind of things, mm-hmm. or lock and load or mafia, postal. Things like that, they just don't really want to see them on the road. But it is kind of interesting that some of them also get rejected for being misleading. So somebody requested Al Unser. Sorry, it wasn't Al Unser. They couldn't get it. First lady, cop, FBI. Another plate that they considered misleading, which I found they were maybe being presumptuous, it just said God. That didn't fly, although some of the other ones did get through. Voodoo got through. Why Jesus got through.
I've seen that one.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming, it could be that the driver of the car is Jesus.
Yes, that could be.
Right.
Could be. And you could always appeal the decision if you disagree with, you know, the censors of the DMV. You can appeal, and people have successfully. Somebody actually took it to court and brought it all the way, I think, to the Supreme Court, and wound up getting a Bible reference in there.
Hmm. Wow. All right. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. He is the Duke of Newbury, and I'm sure he'd like a license plate that just reads Duke. But, Fred, what do you got for us?
So I'm wondering if you could have 10X on your license plate.
10X?
Yeah, 10X.
Why would that be offensive or not get through? I'm not sure I understand. Although, when we talk more to Ken, some of the ones that they've been able to ferret out and understand that there's something, you know, off-putting by it is incredible. But, Fred, what's 10X?
Do you know, does the your guest know what 10X is?
Neither of us do.
No, I don't get that one.
Oh, okay. If you're a shooter for competition, 10X is a perfect score.
Oh, okay. On a target.
So, you know, I seriously doubt that would get flagged. I mean, there were definitely some gun firearm related ones, you know, G4 higher, gunfighter. Mm-hmm. Got rejected. Hitman got rejected. Hurt Me got rejected. Even Gut Pile, which is probably a hunting reference, I assume, was rejected. Zombie got through. but, you know, and there were even some things, you know, so if you're a Jimi Hendrix fan, Purple Haze would get rejected because apparently it kind of trips their drug reference.
Yeah.
Radar. Funked, F-U-N-K-E-D, might be a little too close to something I can't say on the air.
That's correct.
but, you know, even I Got PMS was rejected. Junkie, and a lot of things that were just sort of, you read them backwards, you'll figure out what they are. Redneck didn't get through. Sauced was considered too saucy. Toe Jam, a little too offensive for them.
Oh.
That's interesting. And, of course, foreign words that, you know, would not be able to say on the air as well. But it's an interesting mix of things. Fly High apparently tripped their drug radar, even though it might have just been somebody who has a private plane.
Yeah, oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned foreign words. They flag upside down and backwards. They also take a look at.
Oh yeah, and it's, you know, I don't know how much time they spend on these things, but clearly, and it's not like this is done with some kind of computer software that's trying to figure things out. I mean, there were definitely some, again, I can't say them on the air, but they were sort of a string of seven-letter acronyms, mm-hmm. and even if I Googled it, I couldn't find, and apparently DMV figured out what they were trying to say. And that's pretty impressive because, you know, they're not making six-figure salaries there.
Yeah, I was really impressed by, like you said, the some of them that showed up in your column, that how in the world did someone figure this out? You know, like 10X, for instance, from Fred. Now, you know, someone who shoots definitely probably knew exactly what he was talking about. But if that came into the two of us, we'd have no idea that there'd be, you know, what that even meant. Maybe you do then go Google everything that it could possibly be. Now, when someone gets rejected, Ken, do they receive an explanation rejection letter?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think they pretty much just say, you know, sorry, we can't do that.
and you know why.
usually, you know, it may actually say something, you know, that the actual explanation that's in the database is considered offensive and poor taste, or, you know, sorry, you can't have an alcohol reference on your your license plate.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the ones that I thought were so funny is that people would actually want on their car in the first place.
Yeah.
Why somebody would want DUI dog on the back of on their cars is beyond me.
You know, anytime they're out driving around about 2:30 a.m., they're going to get pulled over.
Oh, exactly. No, somebody asked for no tags. That's probably more of a administrative problem because it probably just trips all sorts of things in the system.
Yeah. Do you have any idea of how many people apply for vanity plates each year and what percentage get rejected?
Oh, I don't know that. I wish I did. And this, I should point out that this list goes back decades. This list has been around since before all this, the entire system was all being done computerized. But there's certainly some on the list that, you know, might have been offensive at some point, but maybe not so much today. So apparently Big Cigar got flagged as being sexual. Maybe during the Clinton years.
Yeah, I would think that was probably a 90s one. Quickly, Ken, we're almost out of time. How much does somebody pay extra to have a vanity plate?
Yeah, I think it's about $50.
Yeah, over and above.
Don't call me on that.
Okay. We'll take a look at that.
I'll get a nasty phone call from the DMV.
Yeah, right.
Maybe it's a little bit more than that. I thought about getting them myself, but.
Well, next time we'll find out what yours would be, but just want to let people know who are Seinfeld fans, sorry, you can't get Kramer's ass man. That is verboten as well. All right. You can read
Ken. I can't get the name of this column either.
That's right. WTF. You can read Ken Picard's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Ken, thanks for being on the show again.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, drive safely. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to speak with Governor Phil Scott. And today, 5:30 to 7, following the afternoon news service, you can listen to the Brady Farkas Show, then enjoy your evening repast with Dinner Jazz with Jumpin' Johnny Wilson. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I mentioned earlier in the show that it has been 20 months now for Governor Phil Scott to have to run our state government and manage the health and welfare of all of us during this pandemic. I know he'll be the first to deflect praise to all those in his administration and those working for the state. So, Governor Scott, as we get ready to celebrate Thanksgiving tomorrow, allow me for the people of Vermont to thank you and all those working for the state for the effort and sacrifices of you all made through this pandemic. We are thankful.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rick. But it really, all the accolades go to the people of Vermont and for all that they've had to endure and all that they're doing, and having the right attitude has been tremendously helpful. And again, as we go into this Thanksgiving weekend, I think about all the folks that the first responders, those EMS has been an integral part of our vaccination program. But on a day-to-day basis, they're on the front lines. And those in public safety aren't going to have Thanksgiving off. I mean, there's just so many folks that are doing remarkable things in Vermont and for the right reasons. So we have a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah, and you mentioned those with the vaccines, the National Guard women and men. I got my booster from them and done so expertly. So thanks to them as well. Listeners, to ask Governor Scott a question, share a comment, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It has been a very interesting week and a half in Vermont politics, Governor. Were you surprised by Senator Leahy's decision to not seek reelection?
You know, I had mixed emotions. I have commented on this a few times. Very disappointed in some respects because I have a great relationship with Senator Leahy. He's done so much for Vermont, and almost every week we talk about things that Vermont needs and our challenges and so forth. And he really cares about people. So we know how Washington works. It's especially in the Senate. It's all seniority based, and being the longest serving senator at this point, being the dean of the Senate, being chair of the Appropriations Committee, we have to appreciate how much that's meant to Vermont in so many different ways. And so disappointment from that standpoint. But again, he, you know, he deserves, he and Marcel, on the other hand, deserve to enjoy all of Vermont, all the things that he helped create, all the money he brought to Vermont to make it the special place it is. I think he deserves to enjoy some of that, both of them. So they paid their dues, and I fully, fully understand and respect that he wants to come home. And but on the other hand, the games are now going to begin in Vermont, and that's going to take maybe our focus away from some of the issues that we desperately need to confront.
48 years is a long time of public service to the state of Vermont. So I guess we can understand him finally saying, okay, I'm done. Now, I know you prefer to wait until after the legislative session before announcing your plans about running for a position or not, but the circumstances definitely different this time. You are the top Vermont Republican elected official, and many people, well, at least me, have been floating your name to run for the vacated Senate seat. Have you considered the possibility of running for the U.S. Senate?
No, I've closed that door and did so early because I didn't want people to get the wrong idea. I have no interest in going to Washington, either for the Senate seat or the potential. It appears now that there'll be an opening for the House as well, mm-hmm. with Peter Welch stepping up to run for the Senate. And it's not as though I do believe we need more moderates, more centrists to be involved in Washington. It's become so polarized, and the extremes of both parties are really part of the problem. Not enough centrists there. So I hope that there are centrists and moderates that are considering running for that position because we need to bring our country together some way. But unfortunately, being a part of that at this point in my life isn't something that I'm really interested in. And you'd be very much in the minority as a centrist. Take Senator Manchin, for instance. I appreciate his perspective on many different areas, and he is. You know, he's one of the few that are squarely in the middle.
Yeah. Should I assume correctly that you will wait again as far as your decision on running for reelection until after the legislative session?
Yeah, it'll be certainly after the start of the session, maybe somewhere in between I'll make my decision. I just haven't made up my mind at this point. But I will say, anyone who knows me knows that I like to finish what I start, so we'll see what happens. But it won't be for a bit.
Okay, let's go to Corinth and speak with Forbes, who's on the line. Hi, Forbes.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Governor.
Hey,
in trying to pass legislation or oppose it, how much political gamesmanship is involved by all parties?
And are you talking on the state level here, Forbes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Governor?
Maybe just run that by me once again.
So the question was, in getting legislation passed, how much political gamesmanship goes on you know, in trying to get a bill enacted?
Yeah, it's all politics. You know, I wouldn't say every bill that goes forward has a political attachment, but most do. You look at the number of bills that are introduced in a year's time in the state legislature. You know, thousands of bills. Some of them are just to satisfy a constituent. It never is taken up, but it does get some attention. And unfortunately, you know, with all of the hyper partisanship at this point and all the number of people who are vying for different positions, both in the federal government and in state government, this session has the makings of being very political just because they need to get their name out. They need to make a splash. They need to be in the press and the media to get known. And unfortunately, that does bog us down. We, again, from my standpoint, we're receiving an unprecedented amount of money from Washington. And you can argue about whether that's good, bad, or different. It's coming. Mm-hmm. So we better use that money wisely. We better invest it wisely so that we get the best return on investment we possibly could and satisfy some of the areas that we've been struggling with for a long time, whether it's broadband, housing, climate change, water, sewer, storm, infrastructure, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. We better focus on that and not develop new programs and waste all that that money. But the bottom line, from my standpoint, it's all about people, workforce. What are we going? We don't have enough people for the jobs we have available right now. We have an unemployment rate that is close to what we were pre-pandemic, which was the lowest in the country. We have about 2,500 people on UI right now. We have thousands of jobs open right now. Right. We just don't have people to fill them. So we have to figure out a way to both attract them to Vermont and then keep them here by making it affordable for them.
One thing you mentioned about bills, it's probably a good time to note something, which is how the system works with committees and kind of ferrets out what actually goes to the floor and gets voted on and debated.
Yeah, you know, the bill is introduced by individual legislators. Any bill can be taken up at that point. It's introduced into the body, whether it's the House or the Senate. And then it's transferred to a committee for them to either take it up or not. So it gets put on the wall, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's a bill that goes to that committee. And some have a board that they post them on, and it could sit there. The chair has a lot of prerogative, a lot of power in that respect, and decides what is taken up, or, you know, and what is not. And if that happens, then, of course, you debate the bill within the committee, make any changes you want. You have to go back to the body it came from and then debate it there. So, and then go to the other body. So it's a long process, but the committee has to agree to take it up. The chair in particular has, a lot of power in that respect.
Governor Scott, let's look at the COVID numbers. We're leveling off, but certainly at numbers higher than we've been comfortable with, and that's after a couple weeks of scarier case counts. So why isn't a statewide mask mandate a good idea now when it was last year?
Yeah, we were in a whole different position than we are now. We know so much more about this virus than we did 20 months ago. And I would agree, you know, this is what gets lost in all the hyperbole about the mask mandates and wearing masks and so forth. And it's taken on a political type of atmosphere. I just want to be clear. I think masks work. I think they're effective. And when everyone is wearing one, that could be beneficial, along with all the other measures that we're taking at this point in time, all the testing and the vaccination, the boosters and so forth. But the reality is a mask mandate, as I said, at this point in time is ineffective because the very people we're trying to convince to either be vaccinated or do the right thing, wear a mask, aren't going to wear them. And so from my standpoint, it just creates more divisiveness and have a statewide mask mandate just won't work the way people think it will. Just because you say to make it so isn't going to lead to more people wearing masks. So I think we're at a point where we are giving guidance. You should wear your masks when indoors, especially around people you don't know. But we're seeing a lot of the spread, so to speak, of the virus at this point in time amongst small gatherings. You know, it's like in your homes. Is it at your at baby showers and at wedding receptions and things of that nature? So those aren't conducive to wearing masks. You know, having a small gathering at your home, people aren't typically wearing their masks. So we have to use all the means at our disposal, and we have to be realistic about the expectations, because everyone's looking for a quick fix. There's no quick fix. We've learned a lot, and we have to learn how to deal with this, live with this, because this virus is going to be with us, like the flu, for years to come.
I'll mention again, we thought it was going to last 2 weeks or a month last March, and here we are 20 months later.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You're absolutely right. There is no quick fix. It will be with us for a while. What was your thinking for the special session of the legislature this week?
Yeah, it really, you know, from my standpoint, it was extending an olive branch. The legislature, legislative leaders in particular, have been asking for reintroduction of the state of emergency, which I don't think is necessary, as well as a statewide mask mandate, which I just said I think is ineffective because I don't think it's going to be followed. But I heard, I watched WCX, and I saw that the Vermont Leader of Cities and Towns was asking for this as a way to, you know, be in the middle and allow towns and municipalities to introduce mask mandates if they so choose. And I thought about, we've done this a year ago in between no mask and a mask mandate. And I thought, you know, I want to take this off the table. I want to take the politics out of this before we enter the legislative session in January, because we have so much work to do. And I thought, here's a compromise. And so that's why I decided to bring them back. That's why we offered this under strict guidelines. Don't change it, or I'm going to veto it. Don't add other measures, or I'm going to veto it. If this is what you want to do, so be it. And again, I don't think it's necessary, but at the same time, I thought it was a compromise that everyone could walk away from not being happy, which is really what a compromise is about.
I know when you vetoed the non-citizen voting in Montpelier and Winooski, you said it was a bad idea to have a town-by-town approach resulting in inconsistency. With the now ability of municipalities, you know, to pass their own mask mandates, isn't that what we're doing in effect, again, kind of creating that inconsistency?
Two totally different subjects, obviously.
Right.
But the non-citizen voting is something that is going to happen consistently throughout Vermont for the foreseeable future. This mask mandate, allowing the municipalities to do this on their own and using different methods of doing that, is just for a short period of time. This will sunset in April. So over the next few months, this is confined to that. The non-citizen voting is in all reality in perpetuity. I mean, it's going to be with us, and there's going to be more towns wanting to do this. So that I felt strongly about, that we should have a consistent approach, because it does have implications with the education fund and how we deal with that, and the very diverse applications could affect the ed fund. So two totally different subjects, but happy to talk about the other as well. This is, again, short period of time. I saw that the Mayor Weinberger has come up with an approach in Burlington that he's going to present to the to the council that whereby you'd have to have a mask on unless you can prove you're vaccinated, which I thought that was interesting as well.
Yeah. I attended a couple of St. Michael's basketball games weekend before last. Masks were required there. I went to a Monkees concert at the Flynn, again, masks required. And at three events, I spotted just two people who flouted the rules. So it seems that Vermonters make the decision without a mandate. So that's good to see. We're close.
I mean, again, this is something we're going to have to live with. So we have to figure out. Vermonters are smart. They'll figure it out.
We got a couple minutes left. The legislative session, very close now. So what priorities do you have heading into that?
It's, for me, you know, as I said, we have a tremendous amount of money coming into the state. We need to spend that wisely and get the best return on investment we possibly can. But for me, it's all about workforce development. We have more jobs and we have people to fill them. We had this problem pre-pandemic. The pandemic has exacerbated the issue. So at this point in time, we're back to pre-pandemic levels in terms of unemployment, about 2,500 people enrolled in the unemployment insurance program. But we have thousands of jobs with openings. So we're in desperate need of people in coming into the state who we can put to work. So we need to focus, need the legislature to focus on workforce development. It's not all about training. How do we attract people to come to our state and be part of our communities?
And the ARPA funds, how much does that impact what you'll have in your budget for next year?
A great deal in many respects. There's going to be a tremendous amount of work available for everyone, all the businesses throughout the state. This is going to be an investment that that is desperately needed. I mean, exciting in a lot of respects, whether it's broadband, again, housing. We need housing, decent, affordable housing for the workforce. We need to focus on that. But we need people to build the houses, right? We need the electricians, the plumbers, and HVAC, and carpenters, and so forth, and earth contractors. We need all of them in order to build out all these initiatives that we, again, desperately need to attract more people here. So it's all got to work together. We need to focus on this, put the partisanship aside, and do what's right and spend this money wisely.
Yeah. Governor Phil Scott, thank you so much for your time this morning, and may you and your family have a very happy Thanksgiving tomorrow.
You too, Rick. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Mr. Lee Cattell. Thank goodness we have him here at WDEV. He does it all. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here on Monday.